All right, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, children of all ages, do we have a guest for you? He is Max Egan, and his website is thecrowhouse.com, and on it you will see a very interesting collection, artwork, audio, video, projects about contact links and forums, of course, YouTube channel, got a Facebook group, sights and sounds, Max Egan articles, recommended viewing, and also, did I mention headlines? And some of the headlines are, Israel says no to Middle East Peace Conference in Paris. Another one is state-sponsored terrorism. Terror expert says attack on Australia is a certainty, and there are quotes around the words expert and certainty. Single mom charged with multiple crimes faces a year in jail for participating in Facebook food group. New Hillary emails, money laundering, child sex crimes, child exploitation, pay to play, perjury. How about this one? Unbridled corruption department. FBI won't prosecute career criminal Hillary Clinton over emails. And my favorite, moronic politician department. Moronic. Britain, quote, would be ready for war against Russia in 2 years. Well, let's hope Russia doesn't attack in 2 weeks, eh? So, let's find out, who is the mysterious Renaissance man? Because he is. He also puts together some absolutely beautiful images, and I can't tell if they're paintings, if it's graphic art. I just know that it's pretty darn good art. Let's crack the code. Who is Max Egan? Welcome, Max. Good to have you with us. Thanks for making time.
Pleasure to be on the show. Thanks for asking me on. It's a big fan of the show, so it's nice to be here.
Well, so tell us, who are you and what led you to become the version of the man you are today?
Yeah, interesting story, really. Actually, I'm a musician. I'm a guitar player from Australia, born in South Australia, kind of lived on the outside of society for most of my life. I woke up at a very early age. When I was 4 years old, I realized something was terribly wrong. And about 8 years old, I started researching the pyramids and ancient history to find out sort of where we went wrong. And by the time I was 16, I'd kind of given up and became a musician and sort of stepped out of the school system and stepped out of society and toured the world as a guitar player for many years, trying to find out what was going on. It was really interesting, actually, because being a musician and working odd hours and being paid to travel gave me the opportunity to go all the places I wanted to go and to sort of research a lot of the ancient mysteries I wanted to research. And it got to the point where I just thought, well, the whole world's crazy. And I sat back and watched the whole thing unfold the way everyone else was. And it was kind of like watching a spy novel unfold, you know. But when 9/11 happened, like so many people, it became serious. You started to think, well, okay, here's the big event we've been waiting for. It's time to put all this knowledge into practice. So I started speaking out, started making the films, got offered the radio show, and it's just been going forward from there. It's been really good, actually. I've been reaching a lot of people and a lot of people are listening, and it's been an interesting journey. But I don't know, I never really planned on doing what I'm doing. It just, the world kind of threw me onto this path, and my life previous to what I'm doing now kind of gave me all the skills I needed to do what I'm doing now. So you really never know what happens. I think that if you throw yourself to the wind, sometimes you find that you can ride it. And that's what I did, and it seems to have worked, you know.
If you throw yourself to the wind, sometimes you find you can ride it. I like that. Is that original?
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. I might have read it somewhere, but it works. It works. If you cast yourself to the wind, you can ride it. And I've found that with life, if you have no stake in the outcome of what you do, you just do what needs to be done because it needs to be done. And I realize that all of this, I mean, it's a temporary experience that we've got here. I don't have any stake in the outcome. My life is breath. You know, it's over in a flash. So all the stuff that I collect, all the meaningless things that we do, you know, this need to build wealth and all of this stuff, to me, it's all irrelevant. It's not what it's about. It's about living life. And you need to be open to what life is going to present you in order to be able to do that. You know, too many people plan things. They want things to go in a certain way, and if they don't, they get upset. And I put things in motion, and I let them go the way they want to go. You know, if I've got certain plans, well, you know, I kind of got them there, and they're kind of vague, but I leave myself open to opportunity and open to synchronicity along the way, because spirit may have something else in mind that I didn't think of. And if I've got too rigid a plan, then I'm not going to be open for that, which may not open me up to something else. And when you find you can do this, things just unfold for you. And that's the way my life's been for the last 8 or 9 years since I started doing the radio shows. I didn't even plan to do the radio shows. It just got thrown in my lap. But since I just gave up and started doing it, everything has just kind of worked. And if you throw yourself to the wind, you can ride it. But most people are too scared of that, because they're scared that they will be stepping outside of the parameters of society. They won't have the security that they're told they're supposed to have, you know, their mortgage and whatever it is, you know, tied to the piece of land that they're tied to because they believe they own it, when their life is just a breath. They don't own anything. The earth owns them. You know, if you buy this piece of land, it owns you. You can't leave that now. You're sort of there for your life. Whereas if you throw yourself to the wind, you find that the whole world's there. And if you're open and you help people, it's a reciprocal thing. I mean, I don't have a lot of wealth, but I don't want for anything. It just works. Everything just works for me. So, yeah, it works for me. You know, I think it could work for others if they were, you know, open to that possibility in their lives, you know.
Yeah, this is good. Your quote comes close to Toni Morrison. Toni Morrison is a novelist and writer. And she's won Presidential Medal of Freedom in 2012, National Humanities Medal 2000, Nobel Prize in Literature in 93, Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1988. And her quote is, if you surrender to the wind, you can ride it. But I like yours better. If you throw yourself to the wind, sometimes you find you can ride it. I like yours better. I like yours better. That's an improvement.
It's the same thing, though. I mean, it's the same attitude, and it works. It works in life. Too many people have a stake in the outcome, which is what stresses them out so much. Even with what I do when I speak out about the system and become an activist and all the stuff that I do, a lot of people say, how do you deal with the stress? How do you deal with all of this negative information? And I say, it's because I have no stake in the outcome. You know, if humanity destroys itself, humanity destroys itself. It's not my problem. I tried to do what I did. I mean, we're all trying to do what we can. And it's about what we do with our experience and how we apply ourselves to the world. But if you've got too rigid a plan, it's never going to work, because there's all these influences there that you don't know about. And you lock yourself up. You get tunnel vision, and you lock yourself off from all the possibilities that may unfold around you. So you shouldn't really have a stake in the outcome. You should have an idea of where you want to go and let the universe lead you there. And it works for me. And people that I talk to this about, if they try it, I've found it works for them as well. It's worked for my sister. It works for all sorts of people who suddenly see that there's another way of doing things. And they can just have faith in themselves and in the goodness of their spirit. And if they're, you know, interacting with people in the right way and helping people around them, it just works. Things just unfold. And my life's been like that for quite a long time. And I recommend other people try. You know, we've got to get out of this dependency upon the system, which is the big problem, which allows the system to do what it does and get away with the things that it does, manufacture all these wars and everything. So, you know, we've got to find ourselves in order to do that. I think that's one of the biggest problems we've got in the world today, is a loss of self. People don't know themselves. They don't realize the potential they have. They don't understand themselves fully at all. This system's designed to take all that away from them. To train people, they've got to be a little cog in a big machine. They've got to function according to certain parameters, think within a certain box, and they've got to measure themselves according to certain social and religious and economic parameters. But really, it's not about that. It's about you experiencing the art of being you, the art of your life. You know, if you can think of yourself as an art form, an art worker, a living conscious expression in the mind of God, a thought from the mind of God, here to express yourself with all the creative potential that you've been given and all the opportunities that this world provides us, which is incredible. But we've been pulled away from that. We've been taught to think within the box, act within the box, walk between the lines, and do all this stuff. And meanwhile, the world's just been destroyed around us. We've got to pull ourselves out of that and rediscover ourselves and simply step away from the system. As soon as we stop supporting it, it falls apart, you know. Even the politicians and all the evil people we talk about, these people do bad things, sure, but the real problem is the order followers and they follow orders because they simply don't know who they are themselves, and they believe that they have to do this. And, you know, we have to help people rediscover themselves, I think. I think that's a big way to get to freedom. That's a big part of the path, you know.
Well, I got to tell you something. You're a very interesting cat. You are an author. I'm looking at your the cover of your book here. Let's see. Yeah, let's go to projects, and then and take a peek at this. Earth's Forbidden Secrets, Part 1, Searching for the Past by Maxwell Egan. Let me tell you, that's an impressive name, Maxwell Egan. You know, that's kind of an action name, man. You know, it really is. And that aside, tell us about this book. You've got a if you click on the icon. You can get a download of a, I think it said edited version. Maybe it said revised.
The revised version, yeah. I had a few typos in the original one. Someone went through and revised that for me. That book is where my mind was in 2005. I'd spent most of the time up to that point looking at ancient history, trying to figure out how we got here, what went wrong, and realizing that all of our history is wrong. Everything they've taught us about history is wrong. There's all this stuff lying all over the planet which tells a completely different version of history to what we're being taught in high schools. And I was looking for the way out. I was looking for certain answers. I don't actually agree with all the findings that I've got in the end of that book. I was looking into a lot of Zechariah Sitchin's work and stuff like that, and I was quite interested in what he was saying at the time. And there's a lot of references to that in the book, but that's where my mind was in 2005. The first half of the book is mainly all about ancient history and just pointing out the fact that the world's very different to what we've been told. You know, there's so many artifacts that have been found in weird places which tell the strangest stories. You know, things like, you know, silver chains, gold chains found in lumps of coal, you know, brass pots found inside lumps of granite, all sorts of stuff which indicates that mankind has been around on this earth for possibly millions of years. You know, there's dinosaur tracks that exist with human tracks. There's fossilized shoe prints, you know, shoe prints, stitched shoes that are fossilized. It takes thousands upon thousands of years to create fossils. So, you know, history is very, very different to what we've been told. So that's mainly what that book was about. And I put it out there for free just because I wanted people to see that everything is different to what we've been told. But again, like I said, in the second and third half of the book, the second half of the book, I still agree with that. It was still showing a lot of weird stuff that goes on, references to dragons, references to dinosaurs existing contemporaneously with man, all sorts of stuff. So this sort of stuff's all in the book. But again, when I get to the stuff about Sitchin, I disagree with a lot of Sitchin's findings, and now that I've done more research into it. But again, that's where my mind was in 2005, so I'm quite hoping for it to be out there with mistaken conclusions that I believe are in there now. I'm actually writing part two of the book. I almost had it finished, but lost the file, so I've had to write it again.
No.
I'm working on two films at the time as well, so it may be a while before that one comes out, but I am working on it.
I got to tell you something. I think the work that you're doing here is very, very much needed. I think you have come upon your time at just the right time. Maybe that's what happens when you, some people say let go and let God. And I think that's a very good idea. Otherwise, I mean, I found that, you know, in most cases, the harder you try to control something, the more out of shape is what we used to say when the motorcycle would start getting the speed wobble. You're getting it out of shape. You're getting it out of shape.
Yeah.
Stuff gets out of shape. The tighter you try to control things, the more out of shape they get. You know, I just have a question for you. You're obviously a man with a depth of philosophy. I'm thinking the Chinese philosophers appeal to you. You know, there's a quote about, you know, if you plan on in your book, if you're thinking 1 year ahead, plant seeds. If you're thinking 10 years ahead, plant a tree. If you're thinking 100 years ahead, educate the people. And that's Chinese Emperor Quan Tzu from the 5th century B.C. Wow. Mm. You know, I think Solomon is correct. There's nothing new under the sun. We just forget. And so you've done this book hoping that people will, you know, go back. In other words, if you want a new idea, I like to say, read a really old book. And because these things repeat themselves, and somehow, let me ask you this. There's a couple of philosophers talking here. Why is it people, the greatest lesson of history is that people do not learn the lessons of history? Why is that?
Well, people aren't taught history. They're just not taught it. People aren't given real history, which is why I put that book there. I mean, you know, if people who don't know the past are condemned to repeat it, but who knows the past? All we know is what we get. There's a quote by George Orwell. He said, who controls the present controls the past. Who controls the past controls the future. Brilliant quote. And it's true, because who controls the present controls the past. And they've changed it. They've changed it all. That's why I put that book out there, just to get people to see that everything's different to what you've been told. What is the truth? Who knows? Who knows what the real truth is? I mean, as far as all these conspiracy theorists go, you go down all these rabbit holes, you start looking at stuff. You know, I can prove it's anybody you want me to prove, because all the information's out there to be able to mount an arguable case to convict anybody you want to convict. It's the Jesuits, it's the Jews, it's the this, it's the that, it's the Rothschilds, it's the Illuminati. It's, you know, you can put it all together. It's aliens, it's reptilians, whatever. All the evidence is there to mount an arguable case. So my argument is, let's establish freedom. Let's figure out that we actually have the power to change this. And once we've established the freedom to find out, then we're going to get there. Because nobody really knows what's happening. Nobody really knows how we got here. You know, all we know is what exists in living memory. That's all we know. All the rest of it is written in books, and we don't know where these came from. We're told where they come from. But even when you look at some of them, you know, you go and look around the world and you look at this stuff, and it's different. And then you read another book, and what are you reading in the book? You're reading someone else's speculation on what they read in someone else's book, which was them simply speculating on what someone else wrote in another book. And so really the waters have just been muddied all along the way. So you've got to get back to the really old books to try to find out what's going on. But ultimately, we still don't know. So we have to establish freedom. You know, that to me is the big thing. It's the establishment of freedom, however we can find to do that. But it's not going to happen until people can discover themselves and empower themselves. You know, so how do we do that? How do we get people to empower themselves? You know, how do we get people to rediscover themselves? You know, get people to participate in being themselves and participate in the art of their life. You know, they don't have to be these little cogs in this big machine. You know, they need to just throw themselves to the wind and see what happens, and interact with people. Start realizing that it's not a threat. The people around you aren't a threat. They're in a state of scarcity, in a state of hardship because of this system. So, you know, let's just try to help each other, you know, and nobody knows what's going on. And that's the problem. You know, we're going to keep repeating history. We're going to keep doing this until we find out what our real history is. But nobody really knows. And those who have little bits and little ideas spend their time usually arguing with each other, trying to promote their own agenda, trying to promote themselves as the big guru who's got all the answers. And I realize, you know, nobody knows. You know, get out of this whole narcissistic idea that there's this one person that's going to save everything, and let's work together, let's cooperate and find out what's going on, you know.
Yeah, that's it. I was saying that just the other day, that people want this messiah to show up to save, you know, whatever particular initiative they're involved in. And
they do. And even with this movement, with this truth movement, sorry to butt in, but they do. Like, even with this whole movement, with stuff that I've done, people say, you know, they want me to lead them. And then they send me emails going, hang on a minute, what's this? It's not going to work. We can't just hold your coat and you go and speak for us. No, it doesn't work that way. Everybody's got to throw themselves to the wind, you know, and just do it. And like, even with what I'm doing, if you let go, you find that your path unfolds for you. Like, the universe threw me onto this path. You know, I went through some really weird stuff in my life, like being a musician and living on the outside of society, having this interest of all of this ancient history and all this stuff. And then it got to the point when 9/11 happened and I started hitting blogs and chat rooms and things and trying to wake the world up that way. Didn't know how to function, didn't know how to harness the power of the internet. And then all this time I was still a musician, but music had been a bubble for me. Music had been something that worked. I was able to step outside of society and live in this musical bubble. I could support myself. I could express art. I could do everything. I didn't have to participate in society. Didn't have to fix anything. Didn't have to worry about anything. I was safe in my bubble. Leave me alone. I can see that you're all crazy and I can't fix it, so rah, rah, rah. But then through that, I got all these skills. I got all this knowledge of all these things that I've been researching and sites I've been visiting. I picked up all these video skills and audio skills and all this stuff that I needed to make films. Didn't ever want to make one or anything, but I picked up all the ways to do it. And then right when I was there and I was really comfortable, something happened and all of my musical equipment and my 38-year record collection and all this stuff got taken from me. And suddenly music, which had always been my bubble of safety, became my source of pain. And I didn't have anywhere to go to find solace. All I had left was my research. And so I just really got into my research and I sat down and I spent a year and I wrote that book, because I had to write that book to keep myself sane from all of this world, my whole musical world imploding around me from just losing all of my stuff, you know. And once that happened, when I put that out there and I started speaking out, suddenly I got offered the radio show. I got offered all of this stuff, and suddenly I got put onto the path where all the skills that I picked up in my life that I thought were completely unrelated to each other were all needed to do exactly what I'm doing now. And this was a path that I never, ever foresaw for myself, never planned for myself, never thought that I would be on. Nothing. I'm not a public speaker. I'm not a filmmaker. I'm not a lecturer. I'm not any of the things that I do. But here I am doing all of those things because I just threw myself to the wind and let it unfold. And that's what happens, you know, and you'll find it. The stuff that you've done in your life, which you thought was completely irrelevant, but you picked up little skills, and you picked up another skill, and you picked up another skill, and all of this stuff can come together to make you who you are if you'll just open yourself to the power of the universe, open yourself up to spirit. Don't have a stake in the outcome and throw yourself to the wind.
All right. Now, why don't we make what some might seem an awkward, I don't think you'll find it to be awkward at all, but we'll see. The global agenda and the spiritual nature of the things you're talking about as relates to the people who are going to be victims of the global agenda if they're not careful.
Well, yeah, the thing is, you've got to know yourself in order to stand up against it. I mean, when I do what I do and I speak out against this system, I'm very brutal and very blunt against this system. I'm very outspoken. Anyone's listened to my radio shows, I don't know how you get away with saying what you say. I say, well, it's because it's true. And if they were to ever argue or take me to court or whatever, I can show that it's true, and I could probably turn it around onto them. You know, I might die in the attempt, but hey, it doesn't matter. I'm going to die anyway. I've got no stake in the outcome. I've lived a pretty good life. I'm nearly 60. So, you know, it doesn't matter. I'm not concerned about that. I mean, death is the one part of life that's inevitable. So I have no fear of that. If you haven't got a spiritual aspect to this, if you can't know yourself, and even with what I'm saying, I mean, it's spiritual to a degree, but really it's just knowing. It's just knowing yourself. It's even beyond spirituality. It's just knowing the value of yourself, knowing that everybody has value and that you have power. I mean, everything we're facing, every bad thing, every good thing that exists in the world ultimately comes from a thought that appeared in the mind of a person. A single person had that thought, it resonated with others, and that idea became reality for everybody. A single thought in the mind of a single individual. We all have that potential. We may not have the money, we may not have the status or whatever, but we all have the potential for that idea, and that spark can travel. So, you know, once you realize the value of yourself and you simply stand up and say, hey, I'm not going to do this anymore, then it just works. I mean, I've lived on the outside of society my whole life. You know, I've traveled all over the world. I've snuck into Gaza Strip and out of Gaza Strip even. So, you know, I've done all sorts of stuff. You can do it if you've got that confidence in yourself and you have no stake in the outcome. I mean, sure, I realize that this isn't going to work for everybody. I mean, when I traveled across the United States last year, I went out through Pittsburgh and I went out through a lot of really industrial areas, through Lima, Ohio, and people that I see that are living in upstate New York and stuff. I mean, it's hard for these people. And even with what I say on the radio shows and I tell themselves to apply themselves to their community, there's some places you just can't do it. So you've got to have that spiritual strength in yourself and be prepared to simply step off the ride, step off the train, go somewhere else, do something else, throw yourself to the wind, get out of the position that you're in. If you don't like it, go do something else. You don't have to have the house and the mortgage and all that stuff. You're not going to have it anyway. It's going to be gone soon because you're going to be gone soon. And you're going to find out that you missed out on your life because you didn't participate in yourself. You participated in all the stuff society said you had to do, but you don't have to do that. You know, we don't have to go and fight these wars. We don't have to do any of this stuff. You know, the order followers is the problem. your order followers really need to wake up to themselves and stop following orders, stop going and killing people, stop making bombs, stop doing all this stuff we're doing. It's crazy. We don't need to do any of it.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like to say sometimes, just being flippant, these damn humans are they're unpredictable, and sometimes they're dangerous. In fact, they're just plain crazy.
But ultimately, they're put that way because they're kept in a state of scarcity. They're kept in a state where they're all clawing for the scraps. And you know, it's all manufactured. We don't need to be this way. All the crime we see in our cities, it's because people think they need stuff that they don't need. Or they're kept, you know, messed up on drugs or in a state of scarcity. That's all the money system does. It provides scarcity. It doesn't provide wealth. You know, wealth is health and life and love and your friends and food growing. I mean, this is wealth. This is wealth. This is real wealth, you know, paper money and stuff. This is perceived wealth. And all it does is limit people's ability to get at everything that's around them because they don't have the paper. It creates a barrier, just a barrier of scarcity, which creates all the crime, creates all the social status and all the way we can discard the lower levels of society all the time. Raise the cost of living, raise it, and discard the lower members all the time. Create this homeless, you know, this is the way it goes. It's all about depopulation. That's how they do it, through the economic system, just by raising the cost of living. You know, we've got to get rid of all this and get rid of our way of looking at it and realize that if we know ourselves and we help ourselves and we help each other, we can change things. You know, I mean, I know it's a big call. You know, there's a lot of people here, 7 billion people, and a lot of people in third world countries and stuff. You know, 60% of the world doesn't even have the internet, so how do you get these people to wake up? But ultimately, it's us. It's the technological world that controls all of that. And if the people in the technological world can wake up to themselves a little bit and stop complying with this system, simply step away from it and do something else, realize they don't have to be controlled by other people. You know, we can do things a lot better. There's a lot of people out there with a lot of good ideas we could put into motion. We don't have to be politically correct about things. We can just speak our mind and say what needs to be said and do what needs to be done if we can find ourselves and respect ourselves enough to do it. You know, I've always stressed the power of community. If you get to know your neighbors, get to know the people around you and respect each other, you can stand up together and say, hey, we're going this way now. We can invite the politicians to come along if they want. If they don't, we'll put them all on Christmas Island. We'll give them all a hammer and they can have their war. You know, but we're doing something else now, you know.
Now, I know you've been up all night, and I know it's quite early in the morning where you are, as you are 14 hours ahead of us. But given that, I just something you said that which seems benign enough, you said there are a lot of people out there with a lot of good ideas. Somehow, in a civilization, or whatever you might call it, we'll say civilization for now, don't you find that the object is to get everybody doing it? That's a good idea. We'll get everybody to do it. Sort of a mass distribution of an individual's good idea. And so I wonder, I just want to ask this question, Max, and it is this. What should we be responsible for? And what should we not take responsibility for?
Well, we should be responsible for ourselves, you know, and we're not. I mean, that's what freedom is. People want freedom, but they don't want self-responsibility, you know, and we shouldn't have to be responsible for other people. We shouldn't have to be responsible for the government. And look at the stuff the government's doing, you know, and we're supporting this. It's mind-boggling what's going on here, you know, but we need self-responsibility is what we need, and that's going to take a lot. You know, to get any type of freedom, it's going to take at least a generation because you need to re-educate people in how to think properly and how to govern themselves and be responsible for themselves, because that's what freedom is. Freedom is being responsible for everything you say and do, being responsible for your own life, supplying your own life with what you need and you know, supplying the people around you, helping people around you. But not all this competition. We need to live in cooperation, not competition. It's hard to say what should we not be responsible for. I mean, we should be responsible for all of our actions, but we've got to stop these wars. We've got to start taking responsibility for our governments as well, because ultimately we're supporting this. By even participating in this system, we're supporting it. You know, we don't ask the right questions. We don't ever question our slavery. And it is a slavery system. We all live in a system of slavery, in a system of debt slavery, where we've got to walk between the lines and do what we're told. And we've got to change it. We've got to change it. I mean, ultimately, self-responsibility is the big thing. Well, like I said, that's going to take a generation at least. You've got to re-educate people on how to think, because, I mean, look what they've done to the education system. There's not too many people can think very clearly anymore that are coming out of the education system. There really isn't, you know, Common Core and all the stuff they're doing. And people are too scared to think outside of the box now. So it's a big thing. Self-responsibility, we just don't have any. We always like to fob it off to somebody else. You know, oh, the government's responsible, they're responsible. Well, we are, really, because we don't know ourselves. But again, where does that go? We've been trained not to know ourselves. So you can't blame the people. You can get angry and frustrated about it, but you can't blame them, because they've been herded into this way of thinking, you know. So, yeah, it's a big one, man. It's a tall question, that one. Who do you think? What do you think we should be responsible and not responsible for? I'll spin that one back on you.
Well, you know, there seems to be a fine line between serving yourself and serving others. I find the best thing to do is mind your own business, mostly. But
you know what? I've always said that there's one law of creation, and that is unconditional love and service to creation, which means that you don't serve others at the expense of yourself, but you don't serve yourself at the expense of others. But again, you know, you can't deplete yourself to serve others all the time. That's not service to creation, because you're not serving yourself. You've got to serve yourself as well, but not at the expense of other people. So it's a fine line. This is why every radio show I finish with in Lakesh, which means I am another yourself. I think if we could view people as another expression of creation, simply ourselves, you view the world as if there's only one of us here, only really one single consciousness here experiencing itself through 7 billion different perspectives, all completely unique to themselves. And when you can see that, you look at someone, you meet them, new person, it's wow, it's another version of me looking at the world through those eyes with those physical attributes and all the things that go with that. That gives them the potential that they have to experience the world from that unique perspective that is you. No one can ever be you. No one can ever experience the world like you or through your eyes. You are perfect at being you. So why would you ever consider yourself to be anything but perfect? Why would you consider anyone else to be anything but perfect? Even if they've got physical flaws or whatever, they've got them because they need them to experience life from that perspective. And that perspective is needed, otherwise they wouldn't be here. So what's wrong with it all? What's wrong with us? Why can't we see this value in each other? You know, if we could see that, we could change the world in 3 seconds. We just change our perspective. Oh, my God, isn't it incredible that we're all here? It's just amazing. You know, we can change the world instantly if we could change our attitude, you know?
All right. Now, and I'm not dodging your question about what do I think we should be responsible for and whatnot. I'm thinking about, and the appropriate answer. But before I get into that, let me ask you this. You know, it is said that when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. The problem with that is you may not recognize the teacher when that teacher appears, and you'll miss. And the other thing is that you mentioned we need to re-educate some people on how to think about things a little bit differently. But who should we entrust that teaching to in this re-educational process? One of the things that I've liked very much about, and I must say, given the choice between the two candidates, I am delighted with Donald Trump. One of the things that he said is, we're going to get rid of this Common Core, this disaster of an education system. It's teaching nothing. And he's entirely correct. I mean, people are being graduated. They can't even bloody read, man. It's bad. So, and then they go into debt for a college education because they're not ready for college at all. Their reading and reasoning skills are bad because their reading is bad. Because their reading is bad, they cannot teach themselves anything that they would maybe like to learn. They speak and they don't necessarily know what they're saying. So I'm wondering, how do you find the teachers who can be trusted to re-educate people?
Look, I think you're going to find that there's a lot of good teachers out there that want to teach children a lot of different stuff to what they're being taught. however we do it, there's a way to do it. I mean, there's still good teachers out there. There's still old teachers out there you can get back in that would like to do things the old ways. And I know people that work in the education system who want to be able to teach the children proper things, but they're simply not allowed to. Their hands are tied by the education system. So there's ways to do it. I think we can do it. Getting rid of Common Core is a must. We've got to put education back into the education system because there isn't any. At the moment, it's indoctrination and it's training. And like you say, they're coming out quite illiterate and they're getting themselves in massive amounts of debt. So basically, it's just creating this whole debt slavery system. It's just starting it from a very early age, getting people through school who have got no idea what's going on, getting them out there in massive amounts of debt, and then they've got to go and find a job in order to pay off their student loan. They spend their whole life doing that and never got any hope of anything because they start off in debt as soon as they leave the education system, which doesn't educate them. It just trains them to not think, really, and certainly not think for themselves. And teaches them what to think, not how to think. So, yeah, I mean, I'm delighted that Donald Trump is the one who got the presidency. I don't support either candidate either. I mean, I think his presidency may well be disastrous, but it's certainly going to be better than Hillary Clinton. Hillary Clinton is a career criminal. She should be in jail or hung already for her war crimes and her support of terrorism in the Middle East, the weapons and money she's funneled in there, Benghazi. I mean, just the way she cackled as Gaddafi was raped on television and murdered so brutally, absolutely disgraceful that this woman could even be allowed to run for office. So facing that, Donald Trump is a bit of a saint. But as far as a politician goes, I mean, I think we're in for a bit of a circus, to be honest. I hope not. I mean, I hope he does some good stuff. You never know. Maybe he will. Maybe this is something that will change things. Maybe the wheels have fallen off their system, but that will remain to be seen. I don't trust him. I don't trust anybody. So, what is it? I say I'm too much of a skeptic to ignore the possibility of anything. So, we never know where it's going to go.
Yeah, I think it'll be a good circus. I noticed that I don't expect you to have paid much attention to American politics, but this. This fellow in Congress, Paul Ryan, he's man. I read people's voices pretty well. He's like, I'm really kind of sorry about anything I said that would seemed a little untoward toward our president elect, and we've got to unite. We've got to be together. It's like, yeah, that's exactly right, Paul. I think it's going to be a great circus. I think it's going to be fun. The first thing that's going to be fun is watching the rats head for the exits because they will. And, this is a beautiful thing. I think Comey needs to be thinking about what he's going to do after he leaves the FBI, which I suspect will be coming soon. And I think it's just amazing. It's like, may I just say, thank you, Lord, for getting these Clintons out of here. I mean,
I have to agree with that. I have to agree with that.
It's just what a disgrace.
Lag there. I spoke over you.
No, it's all right. I do it all the time. And it does happen. I'm astounded that this connection is as good as it is. It's usually terrible inside the continental United States boundaries and wonderful if you talk overseas. So it's don't really know what that's all about. Maybe someone's joining our program in progress. But, I'd like to just take an opportunity to thank two people right now. Even though I've already done it at the beginning of the program. That's thanks again, Julian, and thanks again, Edward. And if they come for you, we'll come for them, okay? I think those two guys did a great service to this country by just putting us wise to what's happening. You know, this WikiLeaks thing I think is amazing. No one has ever, of course, right there at the last minute, is like, prepare for a big release from WikiLeaks that's completely made up. It's like, no, I don't think so, you know? He hasn't released anything that was made up. Poor Assange. I mean, he and Snowden have just put themselves into their own private prisons for their activism. But the world needed it. I mean, this is absurd what's going on here. This ridiculous redistribution of Muslims all over the world and jamming them into cities that they don't want to. They don't want to become part of that culture. It's crazy. And everybody can't just go home. I like. I don't know which home I would pick. I'm
Well, they can't go home until we stop bombing their countries. I mean, that's a given. We've got to stop bombing all of these countries.
Oh, I completely agree with that, yeah.
I mean, with what Hillary Clinton's done, I mean, it's a wonder she was allowed to run. It really is. So it is good to see the rats scurrying, and I think we are going to see a bit of a shake-up. I mean, depends on what Donald Trump does. I mean, I'd like to see him open a real investigation in 9/11. Something like that. If he does something like that, I might start paying a little bit more attention to him. But at the moment, I was a bit annoyed to hear him say that he appreciated Hillary's valuable contribution, because I don't think she's done a valuable contribution. I think she's made a hideous contribution to the United States and to the world in general. I think she's one of the most dangerous people on earth. I really do. And I'm so glad that she's not elected. I mean, if she was elected, you guys would probably be at war with Russia within the next month. So it's a really good thing that she's not there. But I'd like to see her charged with the crimes. I really would. I'd like to see the Clinton family really exposed for what they are. And hopefully there will be some major investigations launched. Hopefully he will do some of the things he said. I mean, you know, hopefully this Common Core will be gone. We will see some real education. We will see some stability in the world. You know, there's no need for all these wars. There's no need for all this muscle flexing that's going on between the United States and Russia and any of this stuff. So hopefully we'll see some changes, and it just remains to be seen. But I think it's going to be really interesting. It really is. I mean, he's the last person that you would expect to be president of the United States. So, and everyone thought Hillary was going to win, and I think they were trying to flip the votes as well, but perhaps it was just too much of a landslide for them to get away with it. I think he had too many supporters. It probably would have been some sort of a revolution if Hillary had been announced as president.
Yeah. All right. Let me ask you this. So you went over to the Gaza Strip. You've seen it. You've been there.
Mm. Yeah.
Would you mind describing what you saw? I mean,
I saw a world of children. I saw rubble. Gaza Strip is 4.5 miles wide, 25 miles long, is 1.8 million people, and there's over 900,000 children. Most of the population is under the age of 18. There's no army, there's no terrorists. It's not what you're told. Israel uses Palestine as a weapons testing facility for crowd control and weapons testing. Gaza Strip is the world's largest concentration camp. You can't even call it an open-air prison, because there's food supplies and stuff in prison. These people get nothing. They're kept under siege by Israel, which is a rogue state, which has been basically... I mean, they arrived there in 1948 and started bulldozing the buildings, and they gave 750,000 people 20 minutes to leave their homes or face death. And they've been ethnically cleansing the place ever since. It's a rogue state. Everything you hear about it is a lie. It's apartheid. It's horrendous what's going on in Gaza Strip. And if we do not pay attention to Gaza Strip, then by 2020 it will be unlivable. You won't be able to live there anymore. All the people will be gone. It's horrendous. It's one of the greatest moral dilemmas that we face. And if people do not pay attention to Palestine, then the way of Palestine will be the way of the world. That's what's coming to our own countries if we don't stop supporting this rogue state. The people who run Israel have no claim to the land anyway. It's not their land. They were brought there under false pretenses, and they've basically just moved into a country and stolen it, and they've been ethnically cleansing for the last 70 years. And what we see in Gaza is the last stronghold of resistance, really. It's shocking. It's indescribable. There's virtually no drinkable water. There's 2 hours electricity a day. The sewage plant is overflowing into the streets because Israel won't allow the parts in to fix it. One of the Israeli ministers worked out the population of Gaza, and they worked out how many calories it would take to keep that population alive, and that's all they would let in there. So, you know, they bulldoze their crops, they spray their crops, they allow sewage to run through the streets of West Bank, they turn their pigs loose through West Bank. They've got checkpoints everywhere in West Bank. Mothers are scared to let their children play in the streets because Israeli soldiers take pot shots at them. They kidnap children. They do major organ sales, organ harvesting from Palestinians. They don't allow any of the Palestinians that they killed to go home to be buried at home. They take them back to Israel and harvest their organs. It's horrendous. It's absolutely horrendous. It's a rogue terrorist state, and it's been supported by all Western governments. As far as I'm concerned, Gaza Strip, just the fact that it exists, is a breach of Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention. This is a major war crime. This means that every politician on earth who supports the state of Israel is in support of war crimes and is in breach of Article 33 of the Fourth Geneva Convention and should and can be arrested right now. Malcolm Turnbull, who's running Australia here, supports Israel openly. He should be arrested for supporting war crimes and for breaches of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So should every politician on earth which is supporting the rogue state of Israel. And the mere existence of Gaza Strip gives the whole world a legal right and a legal opportunity to arrest every corrupt politician, every corrupt banker, every banking institution, every corporation who supports this rogue terrorist apartheid state of Israel. That's the opportunity Gaza Strip provides for us, and I feel incredibly strongly about this. And I've gone and met the people in Gaza, and I've never met more kinder, more beautiful people with more light in their eyes than the children that I met in Gaza. And the people that I met in Gaza, every one of whom was incredible to me. Like, they were so sociable, they were so open, they were so caring, they were so giving, everybody that I met. These are beautiful people, and they're being forced to live in a living hell that's being funded by all Western governments because the people simply aren't paying attention. And it's a legal opportunity for us all to be able to arrest this entire catastrophe right off the bat. We could arrest every politician in the Western world right now if there is law on this earth, if international law is to mean anything, if they can dare to say that they can threaten Turkey because it's in breach of the Geneva Convention because it's still in effect, well, every politician in the Western world who's supporting Israel is in breach of the Geneva Convention, and they should all be arrested immediately. That's what I think about Gaza Strip. I feel very, very strongly about the situation over there. I think it's one of the, like I said, the greatest moral dilemma we face, and it also provides one of the greatest opportunities that we have to demonstrate that there is no law on this earth, because if there was, this situation wouldn't happen. You know, there isn't anything, not in Tibet, not in Rwanda, not in Yemen. There's all this stuff going on, Syria, all these really bad things going on, but there's nothing that provides a legal key that can be used against every politician in the Western world, and that's only Gaza Strip provides us that key. It's a huge opportunity for mankind if we could open up our hearts to the people in Gaza, but we don't, because everyone's been trained to believe that they're just Muslim terrorists in Gaza. Gaza's 35% Christian. It's not Sharia law. It's none of the stuff that people think it is. It's a world of children that are desperate for the world to hear them and to listen to their pleas, you know.
Say, man, you're leaning on Israel awful hard. But you know...
Good. I'll lean on it a lot harder if you'd like me to. I was really pulling the punches there, I'll tell you.
Were you pulling them?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, I've got a big problem with the state of Israel. It's a rogue state. It's a terrorist state. It's populated by people who have no claim to the land. And if you really want to go back and start looking into the history of how the place was set up, start looking into the transfer agreement, start looking into the fact that in 1933, Judea declared war on Germany, and how Hitler moved a whole bunch of Jews into camps in 1933 and trained them how to live in the desert, and then moved them down to Israel in 1933, down to Palestine, and gave them $100 million and transferred all their assets down there. You look at how all this was set up and how the German Third Reich actually provided the funding to set up Israel and all the stuff we're told about World War II. You really start looking at this and you realize that we've been fed a crock. We've been fed a crock, and that this little podunk state there in the Middle East is who carried out the 9/11 attacks. It's these people who financed and started World War One, started World War Two. They really did a lot of bad stuff. They've been kicked out of 168 countries, or 90 countries, 168 times or something. I mean, these people have done some very, very bad stuff, and they have no claim to the land that they're on. And I think, yeah, people need to really look at this and see how they're being played by these people, because the inordinate amount of influence that this state has over politics in the Western world is what has created this entire fake war on terror, which is a war of terror. It's not a war on terror at all. This whole thing's contrived, and it's been contrived by these people who are the ones who carried out the 9/11 attacks. And that's provable. Any investigation into 9/11 is going to expose this state as what it is. And yeah, I've got a big problem with this state, absolutely. I think everybody should have.
Yeah, that's an interesting code for the cracking, isn't it? I mean, the creation of it. Most people, according to Paul Manning's book, there was a big you-know-what fling in 1947 when the partitioning was taking place or something to that effect. And then in 48 it became a state. And the thing that I thought was really interesting was that according to Manning's book, which is Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, I recommend it. It's good. And he was a war correspondent, one of Cronkite's contemporaries. That deal, the United States would not sell Israel any surplus Mustang fighters or anything else. So this was the aircraft they got were a businessman went to New York to talk to a businessman with a little more power and said, "I need $1 million. I can't tell you what it's for, but the new state of Israel will guarantee the money. You'll have it back in a year." And the guy said, "So I gave him the money." And he bought 10 Messerschmitt 109 G models with an option for 15 more and some cannon and some ammunition and stuff. And this weapon sale to Israel, to the Israel-to-be, was brokered through ex-Waffen SS men in Belgium, which I thought was extraordinary. But, you know, anybody will do something for a buck, you know, in post-war Europe. Well, you can't blame them. But I thought that was an interesting story.
Well, there's so many things that we're not told about it. I mean, the fact that there was 160,000 Jews in Hitler's army. There were 12 Jewish generals and 2 Jewish field marshals, and Hitler's driver was a Jew. You know, there's a lot of stuff where misinformation we're given about World War II. And when you really look at the transfer agreement and you see how Israel was set up in 1933, you can get headlines. Just Google, go to Google Images and Google Judea declares war on Germany, and you'll find a headline from 1933 where world Jewry declares war on Germany, and the whole world, Jewry is rallying to support the 600,000 Jews of Germany. This is in 1933, 600,000 Jews of Germany. And Hitler moved at least 60,000, possibly up to 200,000 of those Jews out of Germany in 1933 and moved them down to Palestine and gave them $100 million. And what he did, because you weren't allowed to transfer your assets, they weren't allowed to transfer money out of the country. So what they had to do was they got all the people to invest their money in farming equipment, and then they went to Palestine and they picked up that farming equipment and they took it to another store and they sold it and got their money back, which was the money that they'd invested in Germany. That's how they transferred their assets. So it was called the transfer agreement. They minted a coin to go with the event, which had a Star of David on one side and a swastika on the other, and the inscription, "Ein Fatnat Palestina," a Nazi goes to Palestine. "Ein Nazi Fatnat Palestina," a Nazi goes to Palestine. This was a very well-documented event that was very, very much covered up. And Hitler actually provided the funding for modern-day Israel. You try telling that to people, they just look at you like you've got two heads. But it's true. The book, you can buy a book called The Transfer Agreement by Edwin Black, who's a Jewish scholar who uncovered all this paper trail. So nothing that we're told is the truth. You know, this state was set up to create all the instability in the Middle East that is created since it was been set up. All this whole concept of Muslim terrorists, this is not true. The Muslims aren't terrorists. Israel's gone in there and created all these terrorists. And I mean, if you're going to bomb people all day, what do you think they're going to turn into? You're going to bomb families indiscriminately, drone strikes all across the country. What do you think you're going to create? You're going to get people who want to go and kill you, because they're not very happy. This is how you create terrorists, you know. And you've got Palestine and Gaza right there on their doorstep, so they can present the concept to the world that we're constantly battling these terrorists at our doorstep, when they're not. They're just people that have been kept in prison that they use for whatever, weapons testing and crowd control. All these knife attacks and stuff, this is rubbish. They just shoot someone and throw a knife on the ground and say, "Oh, they attacked me with a knife." Wait, why is some woman going to attack 6 armed guards wearing body armor with a knife, you know? I mean, why? This is ridiculous. And there's one woman, they shot her from 30 feet away and then threw a knife on the ground and said, "Oh, she attacked us." And this is what they do all the time. And it's been set up to do exactly what it's doing. It destabilizes the Arab world. It gets the whole Arab world outraged. And they get to test all their weapons, test all their new crowd control. You get British police, American police going over there and training with them. You know, they can use live targets. They can use live ammunition on live targets and see what effect it really has. And that's what they do, experimental ammunition on live targets and crowd control and just demoralizing and dehumanizing, harvesting organs. I mean, all the stuff they do, it's absolutely outrageous. But when you look at the history of how this was set up and who runs it, where the funding came from, what it's really all about, it's nothing to do with what we're being told. And even if those who want to go and support the whole Holocaust and all that, well, I look at the figure of 6 million Jews in the Holocaust and ask yourself why, when two or three years ago, the figures at Auschwitz were revised from 4 million down to 1 million, why wasn't that 6 million figure revised as well? And we won't even get into that topic, but there's a lot wrong with modern day Israel. There's a lot wrong with how it was set up. There's a lot wrong with what we're being told about it. And there's a lot wrong with what it's doing. And if you look at the war on terror and the countries that are being destabilized, and you go and look at Odinin's plan for greater Israel, which talks about destroying all of these countries, Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, all these countries, turning it all into greater Israel, then you see what's happening there right now. And there's another document called the Kalergi Plan, which was written in 1928, which talks about the destruction of Europe via mass migration, which is another Jewish plan, the Kalergi Plan. And you see what's happening in Europe now, destruction of Europe through mass migration. It's all there. It's all there in their documents. This is all very, very long planned. Another good book that you could read is a book by a guy called Mike King called The Bad War, which starts about 1848 and goes right through to about 1950, I think, and gives you the whole lowdown of the timeline of how all this went down as well, which is reasonably accurate. There's a couple of little things in there that I would question, but it's on the whole, it's a pretty damn good book. So there's a lot of ways of getting this information, and there's a lot of books out there that people can read. The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine by Ilan Pappe, a Jewish scholar. The Invention of the Jewish People by Shlomo Sand, a Jewish historian who works at Tel Aviv University. There's a lot of good information out there on what's going on in Israel and what the story is really about. And people need to look at it and need to investigate it because it's affecting them in their own countries, whether they realize it or not. The influence this state has around the world is unprecedented from any other state in history. And it's affecting the foreign policy of all of our countries. Anybody who's participating in a war of terror is being affected by Jewish policy. So we need to look at it, you know, or Israeli policy. So we need to look at this and realize all these wars are contrived. We don't need to be doing any of this. All this bomb manufacturing, polluting the earth and polluting the world and blowing up all these people and creating terrorism. We don't need to do this. We don't need to do any of it. We've got to see where it's coming from. But people have got to be prepared to look at it. You know, there's a huge stigma about questioning this state. You can't question Israel. You're anti-Semitic. Well, that's rubbish. You should question anybody who's doing the wrong thing, and these people are doing the wrong thing. It's as simple as that.
Well, let me ask you this. Let's just take it to the extreme. Do you think that the state of Israel should, like, be done away with and just let them scatter? Or what do we do with the people who are there, who are really not responsible other than by being there for anything that maybe happened to the Palestinians? I mean, what do you do with the country?
That's a hard thing. I mean, it's there now. They're not going anywhere. They're there. I mean, you know, you look back how it used to be. The Palestinians and the Jews used to live there. They used to babysit each other's children as recently as 1947.
Yeah.
Why can't they do that again? Why can't it just become Palestine the way it was and the Holy Land of Israel exists in Palestine the way it always has? It always did for time immemorial. It wasn't a state.
Okay,
it was
so,
a Holy Land.
So you're saying the establishment of the state of Israel is the problem.
That's where it happened.
Okay, I got you.
The establishment of the state of Israel and the European Jews, who are basically Khazar Jews, who are white-skinned, blue-eyed Western Europeans, who are not Semitic, came down and moved down there. These are people who'd been scattered across Europe for years because they've been kicked out of so many countries. These are really, when you look at it, these are Khazars from the in the Caspian area, from Kiev, around that area, Ukraine. That's where they originally come from. But when that nation was scattered way back, you know, 1,000 years ago, they became the wandering gypsies and Jews of Europe. But they're converts. They converted to Judaism back in 720 AD. This whole state, Khazarian state, converted to Judaism. And then when they were chased out of the area, they just became the wandering Jews of Europe. But these are the ones who've moved down and taking control of the state of Palestine, saying we're the descendants of King David and this is the land God promised to us. No, you're not. You're converts. You're Western European. You got white skin. You got blue eye. You got blonde hair. You're not Semitic. How can speaking out against Benjamin Netanyahu be called anti-Semitic? The man's not a Semite. You know, the Palestinians are Semites. The Arabs are Semites. All the people from the area are Semites. These people aren't Semites. How come the word Semitic now means Jew? How come anti-Semitic means hatred of Jews when Semite means a Middle Eastern person? How does this even work? How does the anti-Semite, this doesn't mean anti-Middle Eastern person, I mean anti-Jew. How does this word mean this? It doesn't even mean that. So, you know, the whole thing's been contrived. That's the problem, is the creation of the State of Israel by people who'd manipulated World War One and World War Two. If you look at the Balfour Declaration, they said, we'll get the US involved in World War One. Don't surrender against Germany, when England had virtually lost the war in World War One. They said, oh no, don't surrender against Germany. We'll get America involved if you give us Palestine. And these were European Jews who had no claim to Palestine. And so the Balfour Declaration, England said, oh yeah, we'll see what we can do. But then they didn't. They reneged on the deal. It didn't really work out. So they went and basically pressured Hitler and took over the because Hitler banned all foreign investment in the country, basically. Kicked all foreign business ownership out. And so the Jews put sanctions on Germany in 1933, which basically drove Germany back into economic depression. And Hitler said, well, shit, you've got to get out of here. So the transfer agreement got them all out, took them down to Israel. So they set the whole thing up. Go and read Mike King's book. It's very good. It'll show you the timeline, how it happened. And you can go and research it all, and you can find out for yourself, this is how it all went down. But that's the problem, was the creation of the State of Israel. These people, I mean, the Jews had been kicked out of so many countries, and they'd always gone to the Arabs for safety, and the Arabs had always taken them in and looked after them. And then the creation of the State of Israel happened, and they just started ethnically cleansing and turning Palestine into Israel and stealing every little bit of it ever since.
Well, no, wait. Let me ask you something. What about Palestine was created November 15, 1988? Israel was created several thousand years ago. If somebody tosses that into the ring, how do you respond to it? I mean, is there anything, what backs up what you're saying other than, and look, I'm not trying to pull you into some jackpot here.
No,
I'm serious.
That's all good.
We're talking biblical stuff here.
You can find drain covers of Palestine. I got a coin from Palestine from 1927. I got a visa from someone wanting to go into Palestine in 1918, I think. So it existed before 1988. People would say, oh, it didn't exist. If it existed, who was the government? They didn't have a government. They were nomads. The whole Arab region was nomads before England came in and split it all up. If you look at the ancient Arabia and Persia and all of this, look at the lines through all the Arab states. Now, these are all drawn on a map with a pencil. England did all this, you know, Lawrence of Arabia, all that sort of stuff. So, I mean, Israel, the Holy Land of Israel, existed within the land of Palestine for time immemorial. It just did. You know, people can say Palestine didn't exist before 1988. That's absurd. I mean, look at the Balfour Declaration, a document you can find from 1914 that says, yes, they have agreed that the land of Palestine will become a home for the Jews. So they're talking about it way back in the turn of the last century. So, yeah, it existed.
Okay, gotcha. All right. I just want to get your take on it. Now, let's make a radical transition to Amazonia and jungle medications. Jungle medications? I hope you're not talking about ayahuasca.
Kumbo. All sorts of things in the jungle. Ayahuasca is an amazing medicine. It really is. It's,
I can think of at least two people that screwed up pretty good, but go ahead. No, I say I can think of
screwed up a few people.
A couple of them pretty good. Yeah. I mean the enlightening part of it, the enlightenment component of it was pretty good, but unfortunately they had to return to this particular sector of the universe. It doesn't seem to be going well, but who knows? Maybe it'll get better.
Well, yeah, I mean, it can be hard to go back to that kind of a lifestyle again if people have got some sort of stake in the outcome or if they're involved in some sort of weird business or whatever. I mean, the lifestyle that we live in the cities is so abnormal. It's not what humans are supposed to do. So once they experience something like ayahuasca, it probably could be a little bit unsettling for them. Fortunately, like for me, as I said, I've always lived on the outside of society, so it's something, stuff that I already kind of knew. What fascinated me about it was the fact that I was able to see into the spirit realm, and I was able to communicate with some of my ancestors, which really amazed me. And I did all these sort of cognitive tests, and I figured out, well, what's happening is not a hallucination. I'm actually seeing into the spirit realm, because I tried all these different things. I was aware enough to try all these different things. But I guess, I mean, some people, it's not for everybody. I mean, it would probably mess some people up. But there's other jungle medicines such as Kambo, which is quite amazing. It's a frog venom. It's a poison. Sounds kind of weird. You burn holes in your arm, and you pack the most toxic venom in the rainforest into your arm. And it doesn't give you any type of an experience, but it makes you very, very sick. You'll swell up like a frog, and you'll vomit a lot. But I had that experience. I had meningitis about a year ago or a year and a half ago. Meningitis is a very, very slow recovery, a year or 2 years to get over. And I'd had meningitis, and I'd gotten over the worst part of it. But about 6 or 8 months later, I was sort of, you kind of forget that you had it. You kind of just run down, and it becomes your normality. You've been sick for so long that you kind of forget that you're sick, and it just becomes your normal. You think, oh, I'm getting old now. I'm getting run down. And then I had the combo, and the next day I was like, wow, I'm back. I didn't realize how sick I was. It got so much toxin out of my body, and I've seen it do that with people. I've seen people bring up incredible dark, dark green bile and black bile and stuff, and get an incredible amount of healing from this combo medicine. So things like that, I mean, I think are highly beneficial. Ayahuasca is... again, not for everybody. I mean, it can be very profound. It can be very scary. If you're on any type of medication at all, you shouldn't do it at all. And it can be good for some people. It can be not. There's other medicines such as Iboga, which is an African medicine, which I've seen cure heroin addiction. People who've got alcohol problems, all sorts of stuff. People who would normally have to go to rehab centers and go through enormous amounts of physical and emotional pain to heal these addictions have gone and done an Iboga session, which has lasted 3 days, 72 hours, one Iboga experience lasts. But they come out of it and they're clean, and they don't ever go back on any drugs. They don't ever go back to their addiction. They stop drinking. They haven't experienced any of the physical withdrawals or any of the pain or any of the suffering that normally people would go through. So that sort of stuff, I mean, that's incredible to be able to do that sort of thing. So there are some incredible benefits from some of the jungle medicines. Some of the more hallucinogenic ones, I mean, such as ayahuasca, like I said, may not be for everybody. These are profoundly changing. They will change you profoundly psychologically. Like you said, you've got people have great difficulty sometimes integrating back into society. People who do ayahuasca a few times just want to go and live in the jungle, get away from that whole thing, because it's so unnatural. You know, the thing with ayahuasca is it will connect you back to the earth, and you'll feel the living earth, and you will feel the need to protect the earth, which is why even the medicine is known about, because the shaman who are bringing ayahuasca to the world, they're not bringing it out here to try to be trendy or give you a new experience. They come out of the forest to bring the medicine to the white man, because the white man needs a crash course in reality, because if we don't, we're going to destroy the earth. We're going to destroy our habitat. And the shaman in the forest know they won't have the jungle. They won't survive. None of the medicines will survive. No one will survive if the white people don't stop the path that they're on and stop destroying this earth. And it's true. Unfortunately, it's true. I mean, we've got a lot of technological prowess, but we've used it to do a lot of really destructive stuff because of this economic model. We're enslaved to this need for permanent growth and permanent profit. We've got to keep the wheels turning over. We don't realize that the economic model, it's ridiculous. We've got to get out of this economic system, start doing things a little bit more sustainably, start doing things to, you know, manufacturing things to last. We don't need to make things to break so we can keep the economics turning over. It's the economic system, really, that's destroying things. So we've got to get out of this economic mindset and realize that you can't eat money. It's what was that Cree saying? You know, when the last tree is gone, people will realize that they can't eat money. Money cannot be eaten. We've got to get rid of this whole idea of the economy, why we need to support the economy of our country all the time. It's not about the economy. It's not about the economic growth. It's about the people. It's about the people. It's about the life and the quality of life and the quality of food and the quality of the people and the quality of the environment. that's true wealth, you know. And that's why they brought it out, to try to show us this stuff. So there is a lot of benefit to it, and that's why I think you find that people that have experienced ayahuasca are having a hard time integrating back into the city, back into their lifestyle, because it is so destructive, so polluted, but and so destructive to the human soul, so destructive to the human experience. How can you ever be you if you're living in New York City or something like that? I mean, really, you're in this environment which is not where humans should be, you know.
Tell us about your films.
Done 6 films. Did a film called The Big Picture, was the first one I did. Just when I first discovered YouTube, I thought, well, I can do this. So I put out a film. Shocking editing when I look back at it. I mean, I tried, but, you know, I made it look like a film. But I just wanted to say some stuff, you know. But it got people's attention, and it got me on the radio, and it got all sorts of stuff like that. So I made a few more. I made one called Fight the New World Order with Global Noncompliance, because I think that is the best way. Simply stop participating in it. I made another one called The Calling, which was quite popular, which was actually a rehash of the first few films. I got asked to kind of rehash them into an hour-long one, so I did that. And then one called The Awakening, where I was attempting to, a lot of the stuff we've talked about today, really, help people understand the artistic nature of themselves and the energetic nature of reality, how emotions create energy, and you can use that. It's a language that you're speaking. It's emotional language we're speaking all the time, how we're kept in fear, how we can change that. So that was quite a popular film. And the last one I did was called Transformation. Two words, transformation, which basically talks about the transhumanist agenda and where they're attempting to take us, how we got to this point, the education system, where they're attempting to take us. And I'm working on part two of that now, which is called Kakistocracy. And that's going to be part two of Transformation. Kakistocracy is an interesting word that was taken out of the language. They just don't use it anymore. You'll still find it in old dictionaries. But it means governance by the worst elements of society, who govern entirely in their own interests to the permanent detriment of all other classes. Basically, kaka is where it comes from. So it's ruled by the kaka people. And it's a good word, and I think it's very explanatory of our current situation. It's not even oligarchy. It's a kakistocracy. You've got the worst people in the world who are elevated themselves to positions of power, who are now basically raping this world at the expense of everybody else. So that's going to be part two of Transformation. I'm working on that now. And another film, which is about the Amazon and our need to preserve and save that. And that's an ongoing thing that I've been working on for a couple of years already. There's probably still got another year at least before it'll be done. So, yeah, it's an ongoing thing. But I think it's important to get Kakistocracy out, so I'm working on mainly concentrating on that one at the moment. But they're all on the website too. They're all there for free, anybody who wants to check them out. Everything I've done for free, because I believe in humankind. I believe in the spirit of humankind. And I believe that if my heart's in the right spot and I'm doing things and I'm putting it out there, the universe will provide for me and it'll put me where I need to go. And it's worked. It's just worked for the last 8 or 9 years. So that's the way it goes. Everything on the Cray House is free. There's no advertising, nothing to pay for, no subscriptions. All the radio shows are free. Everything's all free. So enjoy. It's a massive resource, over 1,300 pages now.
All right. Very good. Well, look, it's good talking with you.
Been very enjoyable, brother. It really has.
I must, and this is not an admonition. It's just a suggestion. I want you to do a little more research on this Israel thing, because we go back to Hadrian and the Romans wanting to crush out that whole bunch and renaming Palestine, and then the PLO decide they're going to declare a state of Palestine in November of 1988. So it's complex. It goes back into antiquity, and now I do agree with you on this point. I don't mind anybody having a homeland that they can relate to ancient scripture and say, look, we started off here. However, I do not approve of it being used as a tool in furtherance of the globalist agenda. And on that point, I think we can most certainly agree. But
I really need to throw that in, though. Fine. They all got on fine before Europe got involved. They put it back the way it was, you know.
Well, yeah, between the Romans and then the Brits and the And then the Crusades were launched to try and get the land back. And it's just like, it's insane. Like I say, these humans, you can devote your life to studying what they did and another lifetime trying to sort out why this was done. I guess it's one of those things where we had been there.
It's a weird thing, man. Belief systems. It's belief systems. People get these belief systems, they impose them on other people, and now we got to kill them because you disagree with my belief system. It's ridiculous. Let's just all get along, figure it out, you know? It's ridiculous. It really is. It's frustrating. That's what's frustrating about it, is to see the human condition in such a convoluted state due to all these beliefs. It's just ridiculous. It really is.
Yeah, you know, there's a belief, which is a first cousin to an opinion. And then there's the truth, and the truth is the tough thing to get hold of, isn't it?
Yeah. What did Einstein say? He says your belief or your opinion, your belief is the collection of prejudices you've accumulated by the time you've reached adulthood.
Yeah.
Something like that, you know.
Yeah, I think Al's pretty smart.
Yeah, he has moments.
Well, look, take care out there. God bless, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Absolutely. It's been a pleasure. It really has. Thank you for asking me on. I wasn't too over the top. A bit tired. Up all night.
Yeah. Understood and appreciated. Thank you very much. You went through quite a trial to make it onto the program. I appreciate it. Rest well, sir.
You too. Thank you, brother.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.